29 years ago, I threw out an enormous amount of material that I just didn't feel I needed any longer. And a great deal of stuff got thrown out. But the fact that they wanted it piecemeal, I've been able to get rid of all the things I really don't need anymore, including one of the things that I was very anxious about and that they could make good use of because of the inadequacies of their historical collections. I gave them something like 200 bound volumes of reprints of biochemistry.
Mm.
Wow. An absolutely invaluable set,
yes.
Which I collected over the years for a lot of reasons, but one of the main ones was I found that if I had loose reprints and I gave it to a student, I never got it back unless I yelled. But if I had them bound, my secretary could keep track of the bound volumes, and I always got them back.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, these are practically all the papers of the great names in 20th century biochemistry. And I could got most of these things because we were doing this Principles of Biochemistry and I needed them. It was easier than going to the library and carrying home a big fat bound volume for the one paper I had to read. Anyhow.
Well, I think everything is working all right. I guess we can get started. Just indicate that today is Wednesday, June 19th, 1991, and this is Jim Boning talking to Professor Emil Smith in his office at UCLA. Professor Smith, I know you were born on July 5th, 1911 in New York. Could you tell me something about your family background, your parents, and what they did?
Well, history is very simple. My father left what was then the Russian Ukraine sometime around the turn of the century. Because of the obvious reasons of oppression and lack of education, lack of opportunities in any respect. Lived in England for about a year and then finally came to the United States because he couldn't stand the climate in England. My mother was born in White Russia, hundreds of miles from my father's area, and she came to this country when she was quite young, I think, 16 or 17 years of age. And they met in New York City through mutual friends. I'm not sure the exact circumstances. They were married, I guess, around 1906, because my brother, older brother, my only brother, was born in 1907. My father was trained as an apprentice as a ladies' tailor. There weren't that many professions open. People of Jewish ancestry, you couldn't live in the big cities, you couldn't own land, you couldn't do this, you couldn't do that, the educational opportunities were closed. But he was apprenticed to a relative and learned how to become a skilled tailor, and he had that skill when he was drafted into the Tsar's army. And the custom was at that time you were paid practically nothing in the army, and you were given a ration of bread and salt and a few other things, but you were allowed on your own time to earn money. And he earned his money by making clothes for some of the officers who paid for them, of course, and they bought the materials and the supplies, and he was allowed to use the machines to put together these things. And it was his friendliness with one of the officers that he was tipped off to leave the country, because word had gotten around that he was carrying on agitation against the Tsar's government. And he was quartered in Poland at that time. And the Poles, of course, were very anti-Russian, so that with a little money and a little bribery and the knowledge of an underground route, he was able to get out with a friend through Germany and then to England. And that's the early history, really. When he came to this country, he worked first as a skilled tailor for Saks Fifth Avenue, famous department store. But he found that it was very disturbing in terms of the seasonal employment. He worked, did well for some months, and then you were laid off because things were slow during the summer, and so on and so forth. So he decided to open his own little business, which he did, and which prospered, I suppose, up to a point. He was able to earn a decent living and afford a wife and a family, and that was the gist of it. So I grew up first on Manhattan Island, and then when...
Where in Manhattan?
What is now Washington Heights, around 160th Street, between Broadway and Amsterdam Avenue. His tailor shop was near Riverside Drive, a very prosperous area at that time. And it remained as a tailor shop for some years until ready-made clothes became more readily available, and the custom of having tailor-made clothes began to go down. And at that point, he went more into the cleaning, dyeing business, and that's what he stayed at for the rest of his life.
Where did you receive your early education?
Early education was first in elementary school in Manhattan, then later in Brooklyn, and then junior high school, Dewey Junior High School, named for a educator in New York City, not for the admirals.
Okay.
And then Erasmus Hall High School in Brooklyn, and then finally from Erasmus Hall High School to Columbia College.
During that that period, you indicated that you had no early interest in science, that your interest was more in the humanities.
Which is true.
Part of that was your family influence, I understand.
Largely family influence. My father and mother were both largely self-educated. My father had little formal schooling in the old country. When he came here, he went to high school classes at night for several years to learn English, and really learned it very well by himself. He read everything omnivorously, and so did my mother, and this is what was talked about in the house. As a result, my brother developed an interest in literature very early, and I had to read the books they were talking about, otherwise I was left out of the conversation. On the other hand, I obviously played around with mechanical things. My parents thought I was going to be an engineer, and I developed an early interest in radio. I think I mentioned this in my autobiographical essay, because we had a neighbor who was one of the pioneer engineers at that time, and we're talking about 1919, 1920.
What was his name, do you remember?
His name was Lipkin. I don't remember his first name. I know that he later went to work for General Electric, but he started out as an independent entrepreneur and had some skill designs for circuits and for equipment, and he ended up working for General Electric, because I lost sight of him completely when I was about, I guess, about 12, which would still be in the early days of radio.
Yes, yes.
But I built my first little radio sets thanks to some tips that he gave me, you know, using old cereal boxes and wrapping the wire around and building the taps and all the rest of it, and had things that worked on a borrowed headset from him. And my parents realized that I was capable of doing these things, and they finally gave me the money so that I could go out and buy parts and begin to build more sophisticated things. That's how I got started. But I must say that science teaching in the schools was pretty inadequate. I was not aroused by anything that I can remember, either in elementary school or junior high school or even in high school. There were pretty routine things out of the books. I don't even remember the names of most of the teachers, except the physics teacher in high school later on, who was quite good. But I was not particularly attracted to physics of the kind that they were teaching.
Even though you had this interest in radio, which is related in some respects.
It was related in some respects, but they never really got to the meat of what modern physics was. You started out in the same old-fashioned way, learning about pulleys and levers and this kind of thing, which might have been where physics started at the time of the Greeks, but it didn't tell you anything about what was happening in physics today. And physics teaching, like chemistry teaching, as you know, have changed, and that you now teach what chemistry is about instead of teaching the early chemistry of 2,000 years ago.
So chemistry and biology had no...
I did well, obviously, because I ended up in college, at a good college at that time. But I didn't find it particularly exciting. I did better in other things. I read more widely in other things than I did in the sciences.
Was it just assumed you were going to college? Was that your parents' influence?
My parents insisted that we were going to get an education and go as far as we could. And my brother, of course, went to college with a major in literature.
Did he go to Columbia?
No, he went to City College. Okay. The family situation at the time was such that it was easier to get to City College, where it would cost nothing.
I was going to say, City was free, I think.
City was free. Columbia wasn't very expensive. It was $300 a year in tuition, which by today's inflationary standards sounds like nothing. And the fact that I had good jobs while I was in college, we'll get to that later. I mentioned that in my...
Yes, you were a musician. Yes.
I think I earned more in my last year in college as a musician than I did as a budding scientist until I was finished with my postdoctoral fellowship years. That tells you something of the realities about pursuing a career in science as it then was.
Yes.
Well, my graduate teaching assistantship was $1,000 a year in free tuition. Well, I could earn that much in 2 weeks during the Christmas break, which I did.
Did you also sell some of these radios that you were building?
Oh, yes.
That was also commercial.
Yes, that was later on, of course. That was while I was in high school. Mm-hmm. The last 2 years in high school, I had a friend who was just as avid about building these things as I was. But his family owned a house where there was a good-sized basement that we could use as a shop, that he had used as a shop all the time. And that's where we could build these things. And we borrowed the money to lay out, to buy the parts, put the things together from the latest and best circuits, tested them all out. And his family had one. As a result, his family's friends and relatives ordered. And my family got one, and some of our relatives ordered them. And then we went our separate ways in, after finishing high school. He went to New York University and ended up as a lawyer, which was his father's profession, actually. And I went up to Columbia, and I had no time for this, partly because by then I was working as a musician pretty well. I had started while I was in the last year in high school, but only little local neighborhood things on a Saturday night. We didn't amount to much.
Where did that interest develop? Had you had early lessons?
Well, I think it developed partly because my parents were interested in classical music. They knew nothing about jazz, of course. And I thought it would be fun to take up an instrument, but I was too old to start in on any of the more classical things like piano or violin or that kind of thing. And I decided from a friend who was playing that a saxophone might not be a bad idea. It was an easy instrument to learn. And so I bought a second-hand saxophone. I think I paid something like $70 for it, which I sold for $500 about 10 years ago.
My goodness.
It's an interesting story in itself about inflation. In fact, I sold both of my saxophones about 10 years ago. And the inflation in musical instruments, of good musical instruments, has been just as high as everything else. Mm-hmm. And I took lessons for about 2 years from a very, very good, rigorous classical teacher. And what it amounted to was listening to records and listening to the radio and being able to improvise and learn the styles and get some experience playing. So I ended up as a professional jazz musician on weekends largely, and summer vacations during my college years.
Did that allow you to pay for your entire college?
No, I still lived at home, and I got help at home, obviously, because there were times during the year when I was so busy at school that I didn't have much time to do any outside work, and there were always slow seasons. The peak season from around middle of December until after New Year's was very, very busy in those years. But then after the New Year's break, when final exams were coming along in the colleges, there were no dances, there were no proms, and there were no weddings in January and February and March, things began to pick up again around Easter break. And then, of course, June was a steady thing. Fortunately, college was over, and final exams were over before the 1st of June, and June was a solid month almost. In fact, there were times when Saturday and Sunday was two a day. But those were the days before Can Music really had taken over.
Did you play in a steady group?
I played with anybody who would call me. There were some steady groups. There was the June Affair was mostly working through one agency in the late years. Mm-hmm. I worked largely through the Morse Hallett Agency, which later got taken over by MCA, Music mm-hmm. Corporation of America. And that is an interesting anecdote by itself, if you want this kind
sure.
of anecdote. Well, about I guess about a year or a year and a half after I stopped playing, but I got my first teaching assistantship at Columbia, I met Harry Morse on Broadway. I was going to a concert on a Saturday afternoon, and he said, "Where have you been?" And I said, "I've given up music business." He says, "Well, what are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm graduate teaching assistant, doing graduate work at Columbia." He said, "Well, what does that racket pay you?" I said, "Well, I'm getting $1,000 a year in free tuition." His eyes popped wide open. He said, "You should have stayed with me. You would be in the big time." And the culmination of that story is about more than 10 years after that. My wife and I were vacationing up in northern New Hampshire. We had rented a cottage on a lake about 75 miles from the Canadian border. We knew the area because of friends. And in the rain, I was writing papers, and in the good weather, we were playing tennis and climbing mountains. And one day, there appeared an announcement that on Saturday night, there was going to be a village dance in Littleton, New Hampshire, which was 7 or 8 miles away. Mal Hallett and his orchestra. Well, Mal Hallett was part of the Morse Hallett Agency, and I had worked as an occasional member of Mal Hallett's bands in New York, because when it came prom time in June, Mal Hallett had 10 orchestras functioning in New York City. And he would go from one to the other at, you know, 15 or half-hour intervals to put in an appearance. So we went to the dance, and we got out on the floor, and Mal Hallett said, "Where have you been? Come and sit in." I said, "Oh, no, I haven't played in 10 years. So the connections were still there. I still have, at this late stage of my life, one friend from those old music days, who is now retired, of course, long retired as a musician.
Had you ever thought about being a professional?
No. I never thought of becoming a professional when I saw the lives that the professionals led. Seasonal. Those who worked in movie theaters were thrown out by talking pictures, which happened during my mm-hmm. active generation in the music business. To make a success in a good band, you had to go on the road and play these one-night stands, traveling from one end of the country to the other by bus. It all ended up in unhappy lives and unhappy marriages and disrupted family life. Everything was wrong. And most of the good people that I knew who did what I did ended up going to some kind of professional school or professional career in other directions. Very few of them stayed as professional musicians, except the classical ones. There was one group that I played with every Sunday night for some years when I was fairly young, actually, at one of these basketball game and dance things in the YMCA. You play for a half hour, then the basketball practice, and then they would play the game, and then after the basketball game, you would play an hour. And the time while the basketball game was on, I could do my homework. I think we got something like $7 a night or $6 a night for that. It was a very easy job. But this is while I was a freshman, sophomore in high school. The man who played the trumpet with me, Umberto Panino, came from an Italian musical family, and he was going to Juilliard. Well, he ended up first in one of the New York Symphony Orchestras, and then with the Toscanini NBC Symphony Orchestra, and later with the Philadelphia Orchestra. I lost sight of him after that. And the violinist that I worked with at that time ended up in the New York Philharmonic, also long retired. I haven't seen him in years. But those who followed a professional career in classical music stayed with it. Those who were essentially jazz musicians, and the saxophone essentially was a jazz instrument, most of the people that I knew were in college didn't stay with it. That was interesting. That was the difference.
Just as an aside, I have a son who's going to start in college as a music major. I'm going to have him listen to your story.
Well, a number of our biochemical friends have gone in that direction. I don't know whether you know Howard Schachman.
I know the name, yes.
Well, he was at Berkeley and is now professor emeritus and was a president of the ASBMB a couple of years ago. His son, older son, Mark, went to Juilliard in college and has ended up as a very, very good oboist. Mm. And has a group that calls themselves the Aulos Ensemble that specializes in Baroque music. Mm-hmm. And has done very well. And Arthur Kornberg's younger son started out with a joint degree from Juilliard and Columbia, but then had some trouble with his hand and gave up the cello, so that he's now, I think, an assistant or associate professor at UC San Francisco in the medical school. So Tommy Kornberg started out, but ended up as a biochemist biologist.
It's interesting. As you reflect back on your pre-Columbia days, what was it like growing up in New York City for you?
Well, look, it was like growing up any place else. You didn't know where it was any different.
Okay.
School was school. You took it seriously up to a point. I took the music seriously up to a point. I did well in school. I skipped a number of grades in elementary school, went to junior high school through the rapid advancement, so I finished high school actually just before I was 16. And the neighborhood kids, there were plenty of them in the apartment houses around, so you played ball after school. I worked after school a good deal when I was even through high school, actually, as a delivery boy and working in department stores as a wrapper and unpacker and all that kind of thing. You know, $5 a day, this is what we all did. But everybody was doing it. This was part of the norm. I've talked to friends who grew up on farms and they worked on farms. With the city, you didn't work on farms. You worked as a delivery boy, or you worked in a fruit market, or a meat market, or whatever. People worked in ice cream parlors during the summer. My brother, who didn't play any music, I can remember, had a variety of jobs. He sold clothes, he worked as a shoe salesman, he did all of these things. One summer he worked as a streetcar conductor. He worked as a lumberjack one summer up in the Adirondacks. Everybody of that generation was expected to work. This was part of the second generation immigrants. There was no great prosperity. And besides which, I think the attitude was one of that work was good for the soul, and I'm pretty sure it's true. Even though my kids grew up in a very different and more prosperous era, they still worked during the summer. They did something during the summer. And by the time, of course, they knew what university life was, they all got jobs washing dishes in the lab or helping out with primitive experiments or doing all kinds of things of that sort. They couldn't wait to get than just hang around the house during the summer or go to the YMCA and learn how to swim and that kind of thing.
Why did you pick Columbia as opposed to City or NYU? Or?
I was unhappy about the science situation at City College. And, you know, the gossip among friends. City College was overcrowded. The competition was stiff. One of the ideas was, my parents said, okay, you're interested in radio and science, why don't you study medicine? I had no real interest or knowledge of medicine, but if you took a pre-medical course, you would go in various kinds of directions because, in effect, you started doing science fairly early. The competition out of City College was horrendous, and it was overcrowded, and I thought I wanted to do something different.
Because some pretty good people came out of City at that time.
A lot of very good people came out of City College over the years. I think it's changed now because of the opening up of the insularity, let's say, of the population of New York at that time, that anything beyond the Hudson River was the far west. Anything north of the Connecticut border was sort of terra incognita.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a certain degree of sophistication to begin to think about going out of town, plus the expense and the cost of living. At Columbia, I could still go to a prestige school and live at home and ride the subway for an hour each way.
Say, you were in Brooklyn at that time.
And
right?
I rode the subway every day.
That's a long ride.
For a long ride. But in one direction, part of one direction, it was crowded. You couldn't do anything. The other part, you could read, which I did. I always enjoyed taking some literature and social science courses because I could read the books on the subway. It's not like working at labs.
Yes. So when you started as pre-med, you would have been a biology major.
I started as a pre-med, and you had to have a major. I took actually more credits in chemistry than I did in biology.
Why?
Well, partly because I recognized that I think I mentioned this in my autobiographical little essay, that I was attracted to biology first by one teacher whose course I took in my sophomore year.
That was McGregor?
McGregor. You could not take zoology until you had a year of general chemistry, which is a good rule at that time. I don't know how many colleges enforced that rule back, we're talking 1927-28. And the general biology that was taught, certainly in the first semester, involved a good knowledge of chemistry because they taught you the composition of living matter with some very simple primitive experiments in terms of understanding that biological phenomena had a chemical basis. It wasn't just an atom. But the following year, I took Pop Nelson, John Maurice Nelson's course in organic chemistry. And Nelson was the rare bird who related everything he taught in organic chemistry to biological materials.
Mm.
And the people who were going to be chemical engineers in the course didn't like it, but those who were interested in biology or the pre-medical students loved it. Because he talked about carbohydrate chemistry and all the things that went with it in terms of what these things are and what they do in living systems. He didn't teach the biochemistry, but made always the connections. And he was a superb teacher, as I remember. Really one of the great inspiring teachers. And it was because of Nelson's influence, and he was a rare as an organic chemist at that time because he was working on enzymes.
Mm-hmm.
Which was pretty rare for a professor of organic chemistry.
Yep.
In the 1920s, and that started much earlier. As a result, I took physical chemistry and physical organic chemistry and everything else before I finished college and in my first year of graduate school. But I decided that I wanted biology because I knew that I could get a teaching assistantship there, and that was important. In chemistry, I wasn't sure what the situation would be. In actual fact, I applied for both and could have had either one or the other. But I sort of made a commitment to biology earlier, so I accepted that.
Well, the Depression came midway through this time period,
That's
too.
That's right. That's right.
And I was wondering what kind of effect that had.
Well, the effect was that I was not going to go out of town for graduate school during those Depression years because my father's business was hurt. They survived, but it was tough. And certainly the $1,000 a year that I was getting meant that I was completely self-sufficient and even then could even contribute a little bit when needed at home, which became important at that stage.